Oregon Health and Science University budget. And I'd now like to call up Dr. Leslie Halleck, who is going to introduce OHSU folks who are going to testify and talk about different programs. So I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Halleck.
Thank you, Chairman Galizio and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU, and you will only hear me as occasional MC to try and make sure that we keep things on track. The other thing we've done to make amends for yesterday is the numbers on the slides you see should correspond to the numbers in your book. perfect order. So today you will be hearing from four individual programs, and I'll introduce them as they come up, and we will be showing you the material that's in your book after the second yellow page, and it's entitled Presentation Part Roman Numeral 3, and it's about halfway through tab 2 if you're trying to get oriented there. And once you get to that page, you should have to find another thing today. So the first program that we will share with you is the research program. This is a progress report on the Oregon opportunity primarily, and we will share with you the activities that have gone on there, some of the performance indices, and some of the where we are in the implementation of the entire Oregon opportunity plan. And to do that is Daniel Dorsa, who's the vice president for research at OHSU.
Chairman Galizio, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here to have the opportunity to talk to you about the Oregon opportunity, a remarkable investment that the state made in OHSU's research capacity.
Mr. Dorsa, even though you were introduced, would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Daniel Dorsa, and I am Vice President for Research at Oregon Health and Science University.
Thank you.
The mission that we're going to talk about, obviously, is described in this slide as discovery. It really describes the research enterprise at OHSU, which is one of our central missions. And the next slide. This slide shows you, and if you don't mind, I'll actually turn around and use a little pointer on this back screen, because if you can see that, I'm a biologist by training, and I really can't look at slides without pointing at something, so if you'll bear with me. As you know, I think very well, the Oregon Opportunity was established in 2001. It was meant to be a public-private partnership to advance our research mission. $200 million public investment through the general obligation bonds that the state agreed to issue and provide those funds to OHSU. And in combination with that, OHSU's foundation agreed to raise $300 million from private funding. And in fact, we'll see that to date, they actually have raised in the Oregon Opportunity Campaign $360 million. It was recognized in the thinking of the Oregon Opportunity and its structure that, in fact, to accomplish our expansion of research, we needed some new laboratory space. So I will be telling you about a new laboratory building that was created on the campus called the Biomedical Research Building. We also obviously intended to carry out some targeted recruitments from around the nation and the world to come to OHSU and work as researchers, and I will tell you about our progress on that. It was also obvious that this could not be an investment that would only impact the research capacity of OHSU with relation to the Portland metro area. This was meant to have a statewide impact, and to that end, we've created a research network throughout the state that I will describe to you, which is called ORPRIM. It was also envisioned we would create new programs. And so a lot of the programs that I will mention today are entirely new programs that were created under the aegis of the Oregon Opportunity. And so we actually wanted to branch out with this investment in new areas of endeavor that we had not previously been engaged in. And it was also envisioned that we would not do this alone, that we would try to establish better partnerships with other OUS universities in this area, and also with industry. And I'll talk a little bit about how we're doing that. So just to break down the state piece of this into how the monies are intended for investment, $103 million of the $200 million was used to invest in this biomedical research building that I will tell you about on the Hill. Actually, $98 million went into that building. It's a $145 million in total program. And then there were some other renovations and so forth for laboratories that were needed to accommodate new faculty.
Dr. Dorsey?
Yes.
I have to interrupt you because it will drive me crazy. Is it proteomics?
Yes.
Could you
help me? So proteomics?
Proteomics.
That was on the last slide?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Some of the investment was not only in faculty, but was actually in new technologies that are sort of cutting-edge technologies for the kind of research that we do. You've probably heard about the Human Genome Project and the attempt to go through the entire human genome at the DNA level and figure out what all the genes were. The proteomics effort is using a mass spectrometry technology to do the same thing for all of the proteins that exist in our bodies. And so it's sort of the next phase of that effort, and it requires expensive instrumentation and some pretty smart people to run these instruments, and so that's what proteomics is.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. We also purchased a building on the West Campus, the Bronson Creek Building. This was essential for OGI and the expansion of our engineering program. We also used $10 million for the statewide research network, which I will tell you about, and then the remaining $75 million, $13 million of that went into recruitments and expansion of OGI, and $47 million for the rest of OHSU, and then $15 million in indirect costs associated with the expansion of the research program. Next slide. So this is a watercolor of the biomedical research building that was created with about $100 million at the Oregon Opportunity. It's this building right here. It was the last buildable plot of land on the Hill, I can tell you. So we had to search long and hard, but we were able to locate it close to the biomedical research complex here. So these little pop-ups are to show you that this building, again, was created right next to the current biomedical research complex, but it's not the only building that obviously was created recently built. We also had what was then called the patient care facility, and now it's called the Kohler Pavilion, go up about the same time. So a huge expansion of both clinical and research space. And I should say that this expansion interdigitates with the two missions in the institution. That is, we do conduct research in the presence of the new structure of the hospital. So I'm going to take you through this building, the new biomedical research building, very quickly because it shows you the new programs that we were able to create under the Oregon Opportunity. First of all, we created a new advanced imaging research center, which has some of the highest field magnetic resonance facilities in the world. We have a 7T human magnet and a 12T small animal magnet in that facility. We recruited a very high-end investigator from Brookhaven National Lab to run that facility. We also recruited a new chief of cardiology, Sanjeev Kaul, and Sanjeev is also an imaging person, although he uses ultrasound as his modality. So we have a floor essentially devoted now to imaging in various ways. Next push. Okay, so obviously we felt that the stem cell area was one that was extremely important as a very promising technology for healthcare in the future, and created the Oregon Stem Cell Center. There is another pediatric research center that is right next to it that is undergoing recruitment of a new director for expansion of our pediatric research efforts. Created a new chemical biology program. So this is to bring chemistry back to medicine This is not a capacity that we really had a lot of. But in order to move forward our interests in drug development and so forth, we really felt we wanted to bring chemists back into our environment. So we recruited Tom Scanlon from UCSF to head this program. Below that will be, this is not a floor built out yet, but it will be the home of our cancer centers, cell signaling and developmental therapeutics center. Brian Drucker and John Scott from our institution, among others that they recruit, will be on this floor. Next slide. We have a neuroregeneration center called the Junger Center. This will be looking at regeneration in the nervous system through various methodologies. We also recruited a new chief of pulmonary medicine, David Jacoby, and he is sharing that floor. And the next slide shows we've got a little bit more on the floor below him because he has a large program. We have a new obesity center that focuses on obesity and diabetes, obviously a huge health problem in this country that we felt need to be addressed. And below that is the KCI Institute, which needed an expansion of its research capacity, and we were able to accommodate it in the building. So this building then becomes a what we call translational research building. This is where laboratory-based science is positioned to rapidly move discovery to clinical application as soon as possible. And if you move around the building, you can kind of get a sense of what it's about, because you can see sort of heart, eye, just pancreas, metabolism, diabetes, lungs, and so forth represented in the building. So this was our vision of how to expand our research enterprise. Okay, so as I said, it was intended that this have a statewide impact, and to do that, we felt we needed to have a presence throughout the state to be able to conduct research in a more effective way. And to that end, the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Network, or ORPRIN, was created. So it is dedicated to improving the health and healthcare delivery to rural populations in Oregon through conducting and disseminating health research and in partnerships with the communities and practitioners that are served by OHSU. It also serves as a research platform and a resource for OHSU investigators to conduct research in those settings. So this is a history, and I won't go through the whole history here of the number of milestones, but it was founded in 2002 and has undergone a number of successful ventures, being recognized by the National Institutes of Health, AHRQ, and other agencies as a vehicle for the conduct of rural-based research. Next slide. This map shows you the distribution of some of the sites that are engaged in ORPRIN and are being actively used now for the conduct of research. The stars are where ORPRIN offices are located throughout the state, and then member clinics and practices that are participating in the research studies are shown on the map as well. The membership is 60% family physicians, 7% general internists, 5% general pediatricians, 60% nurse practitioners and physician assistants and so forth. So you can see the whole spectrum of healthcare providers are participants in this effort. It also is involved with the federally qualified healthcare centers, rural health clinics, and then our university clinics. Next slide. So that has been extremely successful and has achieved a significant amount of grant funding. Now I want to talk more broadly about the OHSU research program and the impact that the Oregon Opportunity has had on us as an institution. This just shows you the growth of our research awards that has occurred since 1989 through 2006, and you can see in 2006 we had approximately $294 million of externally funded research going on at OHSU. This slide breaks down for you where that money comes from, and importantly, I want to point out that the National Institutes of Health is one of our most important sources of funding for the money that we receive. And these are, again, competitively won grants that our investigators go after and compete for nationally to achieve funding for their research programs. We do get other federal money. We also have industry money, so both clinical trials and preclinical research that is conducted and along in partnership with industry of about $26 million a year that we conduct. Now, the point I want to make about this is that that growth has occurred in, at a time when the major source of our funding, namely the National Institutes of Health, has been quite flat. And this slide actually demonstrates what has happened to the NIH budget. This very nice dramatic rise here was at a time when Congress had agreed to double the NIH budget. They were increasing the budget by 15% per annum. And as that was achieved in about 2003, you can see that, in fact, no growth has occurred since that time. What this means is that while that has happened, our investigators have been able to compete effectively to increase our grants growth. Next slide. This slide is an attempt to summarize for you where we are with our recruiting activities using the Oregon Opportunity Funds. And so there are several columns here. There are what we call scientific leaders. These would be chairs of departments or leaders of centers and so forth that are high-end individuals that we have recruited. PIs are numbers of investigators who have come to us into existing departments or into new centers as grant-writing individuals. Core leaders, that's that proteomics technology that I mentioned to you earlier. And then I want to point out that we're not done recruiting. So the commitments that have been made within the institution anticipate more investigators coming to us over the next 2 to 3 years. And about 16 positions are still anticipated to be recruited. So we're not done with the expenditures yet. Next slide.
71.
And yes, we had in fact anticipated 71 recruitments, and as you can see, we've actually been able to exceed that by using some of the funds in a more creative way with existing funds to be able to recruit more investigators than the 71 that we had anticipated. Now, this graph is meant to show you that what we've been doing is tracking the grant income that is associated with the investigators who have been recruited under the Oregon Opportunity. So we move here from 2002 out to 2006, and what it shows you is that as we started to invest the Oregon Opportunity money and recruit individuals, the grants growth that goes with them has increased to about $37 or $38 million in 2006. So this is, when you look at this, this actually boils down to about $500,000 per investigator that they are bringing to OHSU and to the state of Oregon through their efforts to compete for federal and other kinds of grants. This is, for some reason, a little out of kilter. I want to point out that about Orperin as an example, 70% of the grant proposals that Orperin as a center at our institution has sent out have now been funded. So this is an index of how competitive these programs really are. Because of the investments that were made, I think it's safe to say that this positioned us for some very large grants with the federal government. And the best example of this is the Oregon Clinical and Translational Research Institute, which is a $55 million over 5-year program that we competed with against pretty much some of the highest-end institutions in the country. This is a new program that NIH is using to really accelerate this thing called translational research, again, moving bench to bedside as rapidly as possible. And we were one of the first 12 institutions in the country to achieve one of these. And I really believe the investment that you all decided to make in OHSU was essential in positioning us for that opportunity. Finally, I will end by saying that it is also was part of the Oregon Opportunity, and we take very seriously as part of our mission to engage in economic development and activity in the technology transfer. And so to that end, we have been very aggressive in moving things through fundamental discovery, supported by federal research, through what we call the Valley of Death. So after discoveries are made, it's important to do research to get them to the point where they can be licensed into a startup company or get the information needed to move forward. We have used some mechanisms to do that are really the precursors of a bill that I know Senators Morris and Deckard have been involved with, which was Senate Bill 853, which addresses a philanthropic mechanism to raise money to support that kind of research. We think this is extremely important, and I really hope that we are able to finalize the new version of that bill, which straightens out some of the problems that we had in the initial concept. This is a record of the spin-out companies that have come out of OHSU over the past few years, and the ones that are shown in bold there are Oregon-based startup companies, and you can see we've gone anywhere from four to seven companies a year that have come out of OHSU based on its technologies. And then finally, in the last slide, I want to point out something that I think is very encouraging to us, and that is a number of our companies that have been created in the last few years are starting to receive venture capital funding from outside the state. And I've listed a couple here on this slide. One is a company that is called RTL. It's actually an autoimmune therapeutics company. It deals with drugs that might be used to treat multiple sclerosis. It received $11 million in funding just recently and is engaged in clinical trials for that particular agent right now. We have another company that's based on neuroregenerative drug effects coming out of our Department of Neurology. They have received funding from Domain Associates, starting with $8 million, but it's anticipated that the total funding there will reach about $23 million. So we're encouraged that we're starting to see some of our companies be successful and be noted by venture capital from outside the state. We see this as another impact of the Oregon Opportunity Investment, bringing out-of-state dollars to help support the state activities. Those are my comments.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Dorsa. Are there any questions?
Senator Dickert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, Dr. Dorsa. On the two slides previous, I think it's 24, is there any OGI research component to any of those startups?
Absolutely. I meant to mention that these are definitely a mix of OGI startups, some of which prior to 2000 existed maybe as OGI companies, but since 2000 many of these companies come out of OGI based technologies that deal with speech recognition technology or engineering based and device based discoveries. So it's definitely a mix of what comes out of a medical school setting and what comes out of engineering.
And would have it, Mr. Chair, had not happened if not the merger? I mean, that was the great hope of the merger, was that you would combine this core competency at OGI and electrical and what's going on in the Hill, and that combination would spur, is that accurate to say that some of this would not have occurred? How do you not?
I believe that the merger was essential to facilitate that, to provide the environment in which engineering and medicine could be brought more closely together. And nearly all the companies now that are coming out of OGI in one way or another have a medical focus for the product development that they envision down the road.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Dorsa.
Thank you.
Back over to the MC.
Thank you. Chairman Galizia, members of the committee, the next program we wish to share with you is that of the CDRC, or Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, and the director of that program, Dr. Brian Rogers, is here to tell you about it. I'll just make one comment. When I'm talking about OHSU as a whole, I often use CDRC as the example, a microcosm of where teaching, healing, and discovery come together. They really practice the integration of these three disciplines very directly in the context of helping patient families. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'd introduce Dr. Rogers.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Brian Rogers, and I'm the director of the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center at Oregon Health and Science University. It's a pleasure to be here with you. On the first slide, the purpose of the first slide is just to outline for you our mission. And again, as a center at OHSU, we really strive to really improve the lives of individuals with disabilities as well as special health conditions. In addition, our aim is really to be a resource to the state of Oregon as well as the nation. In our leadership, as well as our partnerships that we forge with individuals, practitioners, communities, and throughout the state, as well as the nation. And also, we're very committed to our, as Dr. Halleck has mentioned, our mission, both in clinical practice, research, teaching and training, policy development, as well as community service. Next slide. This slide's purpose is really to outline for you our major areas at CDRC, and that includes our statewide clinical services program, as well as our Oregon Center for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs, and finally our research arm, which is our University Center of Excellence in Disabilities, which is a federally funded program and is really the source of all our research activities primarily. Next slide. This slide is really, now we're shifting to just briefly a focus on our clinical services. And our primary clinical services in Portland, but it's also important to mention to you that we have a major site in Eugene at the University of Oregon campus, and we also have, as you can see, three major sites in Klamath Falls, Medford, as well as Grants Pass. Next slide. This outlines the breadth of our services for children, youth, and adults with disabilities and special health conditions. I won't go through all of them, but as you can see, they really span a broad range of disabilities and, as well as special health conditions in children, including our large autism program, and also programs that are multi-specialty clinics, including these you've probably heard, our statewide metabolics program, our genetics program, and other programs such as our craniofacial program. Next slide. I think when we really look at our public health mission, I like to look at this as we've talked earlier, Dr. Dorsey has shared with us, the translation of bench to bedside, but also our focus, as well as other centers at OHSU, is the translation from the medical center or the bedside to the community. And I think our emphasis on public health, particularly in needs assessment, disability surveillance, statewide training, capacity building, community-based clinical services, as well as our growing efforts in policy development for individuals with disabilities. Next slide. This slide is really just gives you a sampling of some of our public health, and certainly not the entirety of it. One of our programs, the Cocoon Program, is really a statewide public nursing initiative that is really represented in every county of Oregon. It involves 45 nurses with special training to work in the community level with primary care practitioners to really focus on care coordination in the community. The other program is what's called our Community Connections Program, and that involves 15 sites, and I'll show you those on our next slide. But those sites are really bringing some of our staff out to the community and really working with providers in the community, serving children and young adults with disabilities, and really mobilizing and problem-solving at the local level. And it's a great way to for us to learn from the community, but also for us to help the community and problem-solve at that level. And finally, we have what's called a Family Involvement Network, which really started from a grant-supported program, building families' networks throughout the state, so that, for instance, families' parent-to-parent networks and to work with their primary care physicians and really making efforts for this theme of family-centered care and networking between families. Next slide is a map, and I'm not going to dwell too much on this except I'll go to the back here, excuse me. As you can see here, the yellow dots, I'm I must admit I'm a little colorblind, but I'm going to do my best. But the yellow dots are where our community connections programs are. The whole map is blue, which really just reflects the cocoon of public health nursing throughout the state. And there are a number of other programs that we are involved with statewide that represents those other dots. But basically, those programs revolve around access, helping families access what services that are available to families, and then also learning collaboratives throughout the state. And you can look at the map there, and it outlines that a learning collaborative really working on early developmental screening and looking at best practices on a statewide basis. Next slide. We're also engaged in training, and we have a number of national training programs. First, our LEND program, and just to give you a very brief overview, we have students from throughout Oregon, but also the country, that come through a wide variety of disciplines, psychologists, speech-language pathologists, physical and occupational therapists, all the services that children with special needs require, and we're really training leaders for tomorrow in providing really a leadership program for individuals that want to again, be leaders in the field. In addition, we have residency programs or training physicians to specialize in neurodevelopmental disabilities. We also started the first residency program in pediatric physical therapy in the country. And as you can see, there's a number of other training programs. We're very, very committed to interdisciplinary training. Our care is interdisciplinary, and our training model is working with professionals, partnerships, part of our mission. Next slide. What this summarizes, and this is very brief, but what I wanted to do was to illustrate to you that we have center-based trainees, those students that come to our center, but also we have a lot of community-based training. So in other words, when we total up our total training initiatives in 1 year, we had over close to 300 individual training efforts throughout the state in 1 year, and those participating in that training was over 5,600 individuals throughout the state on area topics of special health care needs or disabilities. Next slide. This outlines for you our, in a summary way, our grant support. And I just want to emphasize that the state support is very important to us. Some of our grants come from the state of Oregon, and we also partner with Family Services and other state partners in our grant activities, but also we bring in federal dollars to help with primarily community-based research. And I think that, again, the total is about $8 million per year, and we have 18 principal investigators. Next slide. Now, what I wanted to turn to is really our quality improvement and efficiency plan that we are proposing this year, really expanding. First of all, I want to emphasize our first two measures on quality performance measures. And what this really is going to involve is a survey of families that come to CDRC in our multiple sites throughout the state. And the questions will be centered on the percent of receiving family-centered care at CDRC, and I'll explain that to you further. But also a general satisfaction question about whether families are satisfied with the health care that's provided by our center. Finally, we're going to continue to report on efficiencies in terms of total services that we provide statewide to children and youth with disabilities and special health conditions. Let me go into a little bit more detail for you. Next slide. We really chose these measures as benchmarks. And these are national benchmarks that we can compare ourselves to. First, on particularly family-centered care, the benchmark that we used is a national survey of children with special health needs that has been completed in 2005-2006. And basically, this involved briefly an integrated telephone survey of over 800 families in each state as well as the District of Columbia. The topics, as you can see, were pretty broad, but included issues of medical, home, health insurance, access, functional difficulties, care coordination, many of the factors that we felt was important for us to look at in terms of the type of service and the quality of service that we provide to families. Next slide. To give you an example, we are going to be reporting to you one outcome measure called the percent of, you know, of families that receive family-centered care at CDRC. Now, briefly, five questions will go into the result of percent of family receiving family-centered care. So in other words, families are going to have to rate us very highly on all these five questions before we are designated a percent that are receiving family-centered care. So for instance, the questions that will be asked are in reference to families coming back for follow-up appointments, such as, did we spend enough time with the patient at the time of their visit? Did we listen carefully to families when they came to us? How often were they sensitive to your family's values and customs? Cultural competency. How often did you get specific information you needed? And how often did your child's providers help you feel like a partner in his or her care? So all five of these questions with a summary will come out as whether they receive family-centered care. And all the families will have to answer to get that outcome, usually or always, on all five of those questions. The next slide focuses on a general health care satisfaction, and the question was really developed by the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, which really used Harvard, Rand, and Research Triangle Institute as consultants. And this represents what's called the Consumer Assessment of Health Plans Study. Basically, it's a survey of over 17,000 individuals who receive their care through health maintenance organizations, both a sizable portion, both on Medicaid as well as commercial insurance. The question reads, which we will give to families, how would you rate your child's care from all doctors and health providers at CDRC during the past 12 months? And it goes from worst health care possible, 0, to 10, the best health care possible. And we thought it was important to give a general, to really query families about how they felt their overall health care at CDRC is. And we, again, we'll use this as a measure for us to continue to improve. Next slide is really discussing the other efficiency report that we continue to provide the legislature, which is really our total numbers of service. As you can see here in the slide at the bottom of the slide here, services. In 2000, fiscal year 2000, 2006, we've had a total of 12% increase in our services over this time period. Next slide. When we look at our efficiency during this same time period, we had a 30% reduction in total state funding support for CDRC. The 30% really goes directly to our clinical services. So we've been able to expand our services, but there has been some impact on the care that we're providing the families. We feel that we're continuing to provide high quality, but during this period of time, we were forced to close and reduce the scope of some of our programs at CDRC. And I think when we look at the data, there was a greater number of annual services, but fewer services per visit for patients and families. And to give you what this really represents is when a family comes to us, we often, a team will see families, so that often they come and we'll see a number of professionals all on that same day. And we've been able to maintain that model pretty much, but we've had to cut some numbers of services all in the same day, so they often will have to come back more than one visit. And that's basically what we've seen over this time period. Next slide. the final slide is really our goal for our quality improvement and efficiency is that CDRC will exceed national benchmarks for family-centered care. We will have high rates of family satisfaction with health care provided by CDRC. And our clinical services will continue to grow in a strategic way. And I think our growth has been centered also, particularly in the next few years, in some of our community outreach, particularly building some of our resources in the Eugene area, but also expanding somewhat in our Portland campus. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that may require some work on your part, so feel free to say you can't answer today, but feel free to get back to us later. I'm just curious about the, if you can tell us the approximate cost per patient compared to comparable programs in other states, given the fact that there's been a 12% increase in total services and a 30% reduction. I'm just curious kind of on a cost per patient basis.
Sure. Chair Colizio, Representative Edwards, I don't have that information for you. I'd be very happy to get that for you. We haven't looked at that, but I think it's an excellent question. I'd be happy to get that for
you. Thank you. Appreciate that, sir.
And just to make sure that I have that correct, is that what you'd like is an analysis of cost per patient over this time period.
Correct.
And how that has changed over time. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Senator Devlin.
Just a very quick one, actually. Dr. Rogers, I see all the outreach efforts in your different satellite centers, but do you usually, your staff, have literally daily consultations with physicians out in the field? With patients that have issues that maybe they're a general practitioner or a family practitioner. Is that just a relatively normal thing that you're doing on a daily basis?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin. We have an on-call service that particularly our physicians that are every day of the week that we take phone calls. So we have an organized call system. And so that we get regular phone calls from primary care physicians. We also take many, many phone calls through our public health nurses, particularly in terms of practitioners wanting to know about resources in the community when they see a child or youth with special health care needs. So we're very active in a lot of phone work. So
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rogers.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Howell?
Chairman Galizio and members of the committee, I would also point out that under tab 7 there's additional information regarding CDRC and in particular regarding the new performance measure that the CDRC has proposed on patient family satisfaction and on the degree to which the care was deemed patient family centric. And so there's extra material, the complete questionnaire and so on in tab 7 if you're interested in more information.
Thank you. And before we go to the next dean, turn it over quickly to Steve Bender, who has some information that will be useful for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to remind you that in the material that I distributed yesterday, on the last page 6 of those slides, there is information you might find interesting as you get these presentations. It basically tells you the level of state support for each of these programs that are coming before you, and also the change that the governor is proposing. So, for example, the programs you've heard so far for the research, there is the support for the Oregon Opportunity Debt Service of about $32 million, but that is no change from the prior biennium. For the CDRC, the level in the governor's budget is approximately $10 million, which is about a 3.1% increase. Now, you'll be hearing from nursing. Nursing is a program that has a fairly large percentage increase. It's about $20 million, and it's about a 40% increase. So this just gives you some reference as you hear these presentations.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Galizia, members of the committee, the next person that will share their program with you is the Dean of Nursing at OHSU. That is Sandra Tice. Dr. Tice, in fact, has been with OHSU for 5 years, probably six now, and spent the first five as the Associate Dean of the campus at Southern Oregon University of the Nursing Program on the Ashland campus, and is now serving as Interim Dean of all the undergraduate and graduate nursing programs across the state, and she'll tell you about the nursing programs and the new workforce initiatives that make up that increase that the governor has recommended in his budget.
Thank you. Chair Galizio and committee members, I am Sandra Tice, Dean of OHSU School of Nursing. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak with you today. The Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing is ranked sixth overall in the U.S. We're very proud of that. All of our graduate specialties are ranked in the top 10 by U.S. News and World Report. In 2005, we were ranked 15th in research funding. Next slide, please. Track of where you're going here. We offer undergraduate programs across the state in Portland, Ashland, Klamath Falls, and LeGrand. And we have graduate programs in those places and also in Washington, Montana, Utah, and Alaska. The School of Nursing manages clinics in Eastern Oregon, and I'll talk a little bit later about the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. This next slide shows a map of our locations. You've seen several maps today. I think you get the idea that OHSU is really statewide. I'd like to move on into some slides about the nursing shortage. I think you've heard some of this, but I just want to summarize it for you. The average age of a nurse is now, it's increasing, and also the average age of the nursing faculty is increasing. The next slide shows the projected loss of RNs through retirement, the projected growth of RN positions, and what would happen if we doubled the number of RN graduates by 2010, and this is in Oregon. As you can see from this slide, we need to more than double. It's the green line. It's the green line in the center that indicates the doubling, and you can see that it puts us nowhere near the demand. Next slide. This is another way of looking at it, the supply and the demand, and you can see that they don't reach each other. This is just another way of looking at the future nursing shortage, if you like numbers rather than a graphic. But it gives you the idea of the future's deficit. So we've been projecting a nursing faculty shortage also, and what we project is 65 FTU faculty will project retirement by 2010, and that's roughly one-third of the faculty who are now teaching in Oregon nursing programs. This next bullet, I think, is important. Due largely to the faculty shortage, only one in five OHSU nursing school applicants are accepted. So what that shows is we have plenty of people who want to be nurses. We don't have the capacity. We project a shortfall of 20% of RNs in Oregon if we don't do anything to combat this shortage. Next slide. This slide shows the number of degrees that have been awarded over the past few years, and I think you can see we have increased the number of degrees in everything except our Doctor of Philosophy. Next slide. one of the things that I think is important to look at, and kind of related to the question that you had for Dr. Rogers, is how do we compare in state support for nursing education? And we haven't done an extensive study of this, but our neighbor to the north, Washington, provides to the University of Washington $13,000 per student per year. Oregon provides $10,000. Another way of looking at OHSU cost covered by state support in 2002 was 50%, and in 2005 it was 43%. So one of the things that we look at is how does our tuition compare with other places? And while OHSU's tuition of $10,015 is relatively high, the average private nursing school in Oregon charges $22,197. So even though we've had to increase our tuition, we still are a bargain so far as private schools go. Earlier I mentioned the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. This is an education reform which was stimulated by the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council back in 2001. OHSU has played a key role in the leadership of this consortium. What is OCME, or we also call it OCME? It's a voluntary partnership of Oregon community colleges and universities. The curriculum which we've developed allows students to attend either an OHSU campus or a partner community college and receive a Bachelor of Science degree. This has been facilitated by interinstitutional agreements among OHSU, community colleges, and OUS universities. And the group of students that was admitted first was admitted in fall of 2006. The next slide is another map which shows the programs where we have Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education campuses. The one that's missing here is, it's not missing, we put it in. We had for a while Roseburg missing, and that wouldn't be a good idea. So it's there, we added it. So we have campuses, as you can see, all over the state of Oregon, and they are then affiliated with our OHSU campuses. So let's move on to what our initiatives are in the governor's budget. One is the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. And as I described that briefly, and I just wanted to mention that OHSU has already made an in-kind investment of about $2 million over the past 4 years, and that's involved in curriculum development, steering committee meetings, all those kinds of things. And the money that we're asking for this would go to the fourth year of the educational program, where OHSU will get an influx of students from the community colleges who want to finish their Bachelor of Science degree, and it would be for the infrastructure for that. Number two is the expansion of base programs at OHSU, and that would be on all of our campuses, and we would expand by 50 students a year statewide, obviously in order to help meet the nursing shortage. Number three is the expansion of our graduate programs to produce faculty for nursing programs, and we would expand by 20 a year. We have already approved a master's in nursing education with a focus in gerontology and community health nursing, which we think will be attractive to both faculty who would want to teach at OHSU, but even more so in our community college partners.
Yes. Can I ask you a question on that
one? Of course.
One?
Uh-huh.
So, if you get master in nursing, you can teach at a community college, but what incentives are there in that program? Because obviously, just the shortage in the nursing faculty is just such a tremendous problem. But if I have a master's in nursing, maybe I'd rather go into
being a nurse practitioner.
So how do you, what kind of incentives, what do you do there?
Chair DeLizio, that's a really important question and one that we really need to deal with. Just to kind of reinforce what you're saying, at OHSU, there's a $30,000 differential per year for master's prepared nurses who practice as nurse practitioners in the hospital system as compared with those who teach in the School of Nursing. So money isn't what would drive somebody to be a nurse educator. What would drive people to be a nurse educator is, I'm going to say an altruistic idea that you are influencing the lives of many students, and you have an opportunity to do that. To some extent, some would say that the life of a nurse educator is a little less hectic than a nurse, let's say, in an intensive care unit, particularly working 12-hour shifts, as many nurses do. So from a physical standpoint, some would say, not all would say, but some would say that it's physically a less demanding kind of a position. But it is one that we're really trying to grapple with, and we would... we would value help from the legislature and help from others in being able to increase those salaries. It is a challenge, and actually other states have done that. Arizona and Texas have both provided funds in order to specifically to increase faculty salaries. I'm not sure whether that answers you or not.
Well, I think you're raising a lot of the issues, just because, and I'm looking at the analysis of the governor's budget, and we have a $1.01 million general fund request in the governor's budget for this, and there are significant cost increases in the 2009-2011 biennium.
Right.
So, when this committee thinks about that, I'm just trying to provide an opportunity for you to say, well, this is a worthwhile investment because we can indeed increase the number of nurse educators. It's just so that
we feel that we will. I mean, even though it's it may not sound like the best thing to go into, before we began particularly the nursing education masters, we did an assessment statewide of bachelor's prepared nurses and asked them if they would be interested in this kind of an education and would they then be wish to teach, and we received overwhelming response that they in fact would. So we know there are people out there who will do this and who do want to teach. It wouldn't help to have some incentives to do that. It's to some extent the camaraderie, the academic intellectual and stimulation that you find in a university, and it's one of the things that I think that OHSU has been able to provide statewide through our regional programs. I mean, I experienced that firsthand when I was associate dean for our Southern Oregon region, because faculty in Ashland and Klamath Falls might not have had that stimulation with research, those kinds of things that OHSU has actually provided.
Mm-hmm.
And many people value that quite highly, and it is a perk. It's not a monetary perk, but it is a perk for participating in an educational setting.
But OHSU doesn't provide any financial incentives to, in other words, you've got people in a master's program, you say, hey, if you agree to teach, there's nothing like that.
No. Okay. Actually, the federal government does, in that practice or teach in certain kinds of environments, you can in fact have your loans relieved.
Right.
We'd love to be able to provide scholarships for everybody. We do have some scholarship money available, but not nearly enough.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You raise a very good question, because when Dean Thies was talking about we don't have the capacity, we don't have the capacity because we don't have the people to teach. So The altruistic reason, a lot of us are here for altruistic reasons because the salaries are so poor, but we care about public policy. But there comes a point where you have to look at your own financial circumstances and say, can I keep doing this because my family is getting the short end of the stick, which is similar to what the nurses are doing. You hit on an issue that I think is important. It's not just increasing the faculty salaries. It's providing some incentives, being a little more broad with the program that allows them to discharge their student loan debt instead of just limiting it to certain areas of the state. You know, making that a little bit more broad so that people would be more interested in coming into the field, and that would increase your ability to train new nurses. Wouldn't that be an option?
Yes, Chair Galizio, Senator Walker, yes, it would. And another thing that I do want to mention, we on a regular basis do market surveys to determine what going salaries are nationwide among nursing faculty, and then also locally among nursing faculty, and then also with what a master's or doctoral prepared nurse would be able to achieve in the healthcare setting, so that we do on a regular basis look at equity, and we are able to raise salaries related to that. So it's not such a bleak picture as maybe was painted, but we'll never get to a point of being able to really be competitive. Did you want to say something, Leslie?
Chairman Galizio and members of the committee, the only thing I would add is that in another portion of the governor's budget, in the OSAC budget, there are some other elements that are pertinent here. To your question, Senator Walker, there are loan forgiveness funds, particularly for practitioners in rural areas. It was the focus of those. There are also scholarship funds in the Oregon opportunity in that context for nursing students. So there are a couple of other sources of relief that come into the budget. And the other thing I would point out, in case it wasn't clear, is in order to channel some of these graduate students into teaching, there actually is a different degree being created that's focused on becoming an educator. So this funding would go toward that track and not toward the advanced specialty track. So that's another effort to really make sure that it is increasing the teaching overall.
Oh, thank you. I think that's an important
point. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think there are about a third of us on this committee, maybe not a third, some of you are awfully young, who are baby boomers, and we're going to need this care.
Right.
We better get on the stick, and we don't have anybody to take care of us.
Even the non-baby boomers are aging quickly. Representative Morgan.
You speak for yourself on that. I won't comment.
Dr. Halleck, can you bring up the program in OSAC that helps pay back some of the education costs for practitioners in rural areas? Does that also apply to teachers?
You know, I don't think it does. That's a great implied suggestion, if I can be so bold, but I don't believe it does. I think it's just practitioners, but it may. I'll have to check and see if it is limited to licensure, in which case it might.
Well, it would be an interesting policy discussion to broaden that program out too. I know that there's not a lot of funding in it, and not a lot of people take advantage of it, but that maybe is one way that we could help with the equity issue a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And the recommended budget does have a significant increase for the practitioners in rural areas, but I don't know the answer to the question on the teaching. I'll check.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Dr. Price, I have a question about undergraduate education. A friend of mine, a longtime friend, is a nursing educator at PCC, and I don't really know if PCC has changed its practice, but I've talked to a number of students there that have went through their lottery system. And on average, I think the years that I was inquiring about, they had like 900 people in the lottery, and they selected like 90 to go into the program. And you said that you actually were able to select like 1 out of 5 that had applied. Two combination questions here. One, are most of the people that are in that 1 out of 5, in your opinion, qualified? And two, do you see the same thing happening that she sees occasionally happening? And it's sort of like it's a good use of public resources in a sense. But a lot of these students who do not get accepted into nursing programs go on and get a bachelor's degree, sometimes in a natural science, but always with the idea, in many cases, that they will go on and try to get into another nursing program so that they can become an RN. So in a sense, because they can't get into a program, we are in a sense making a public investment for them to get a degree, which is a good thing. And then we're making a public investment for them to get into a nursing program in the future. And to some degree, I mean, it begs the question, wouldn't it be better to have a space open for them to get them the program that they want in the first place? And so the basic question is the second question, wouldn't it be better to have a space? And are most of the five applicants that you have per position qualified?
Okay, Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, the answer to the first question is yes, those five, all those applicants that we're speaking of are qualified. So that in a way is even more, I'll say, sad actually than if they weren't if we were talking about unqualified. The answer to your second question is you are correct that many do then go on to get a bachelor's degree, or if they're in a community college, maybe associate degree, and then they come back later on. That's true, but many also don't. Many do then drop out. And I guess your question, though, is would it be better to have something at the beginning for them? I have to say yes. I mean, it would be better that if we could increase our capacity to be able to do that. But we are constrained, I guess, by faculty. We're also, frankly, constrained by clinical placements, which we're working on quite strongly in this state. As I think you are aware, the governor has supported simulation to a quite a great degree in the state over the last few years. So what we're doing with some grant funding is to look at a combination of simulation and actual clinical experience, because we know you can't become a health professional or a nurse without some actual exact patient contact. But what is the ratio of simulation to clinical contact that you actually need? And we're doing some work on that. So I'm trying to say that we're trying to work at how you would expand the number so that we would have spaces available. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
It does.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to quickly go on to our other initiatives, unless there are other questions about those. There aren't too many more. The fourth one is an addition of a campus to another of our regional campuses at Monmouth to Western Oregon University, and that would produce 27 graduates a year. We also have a couple others in your information that aren't requesting money, so you'll be glad to know that. We already have launched a new certified nurse anesthetist program, CRNA program at no state cost. We have a new doctor of nursing practice program, which will accept applications for this fall. We have created a new accelerated baccalaureate program, and we're accepting applications now for that. And actually, the new programs for nurse educators are the ones we've already spoken about. And then we have actually some slides that show some of what you were asking about before. But I think what this slide shows is the number of applications, acceptance, and those admitted. And the number of applications, I believe, are qualified applications. And so you can see that has risen over the years. And then if you look at our the blue and the green, or the, I guess it's blue and green, it's reversed from what I have here. And you can see that actually the number of people that we offer acceptance to do come to us. So that's very efficient.
That's all.
That's it, yeah. So I'm wondering if you have any questions, further questions of me.
Doesn't look like we do. And just for clarification, I'm sure everyone on the committee understands that you've been, the questions that we asked, I think the assumption is you've been thinking about these. We're not, I certainly don't mean to imply that you haven't been grappling with these issues. I was
no,
just curious.
I understand that.
Really appreciate it, Dr. Tice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Galizia, members of the committee, the last program that you will hear about today is the School of Dentistry program, and I'd like to introduce, to give you that information, the Dean of the School of Dentistry, Jack Clinton. Sometimes we introduce him as a Lakeview kid, but I'll let him explain that if he chooses to, Dean Clinton.
Thank you, Les. Chairman Galizio, members of the committee, I'm Jack Clinton, dentist, dean of the School of Dentistry, and I'm very happy to be here and share, I guess, kind of a snapshot, a couple of highlights of some things I think you'd be interested in as far as the School of Dentistry is concerned and where we are in the budget process. I know it's getting late in the day, and I will tell you that the presentations you've previously seen are much longer, much more lengthy than the one that I have. So that's encouragement, I guess, that I wanted to share. The School of Dentistry has a 108-year history. There are 56 dental schools in the country, and OHSU has a very distinguished reputation among these 56 dental schools. As a matter of fact, the first slide will show you that entering students consistently have their entering GPAs, meaning their college backgrounds, are rated among the top 10 schools in the country. I can tell you that it's often the top five, and it was just a few years ago that we were tied for the number one position with Harvard, and so we thought we were keeping pretty nice company at that time. We do have, last year, 1,000 applicants that vied for 75 positions. It looks like this year we're going to top over 1,100 applicants for the class in Lilly this fall. So we're still working on a, so there's obviously demand and a lot of competition. There are three credentialing activities that occur in dentistry to allow a person to practice dentistry. Two of them are written exams that occur during the curriculum. They're national board exams. Sounds like thing one, thing two. It's part one, part two. Grandpa says that, you know, I'm back to reading Dr. Seuss now. anyway, part one, part two, we perform extremely well on these exams. We're always in the top 20%, so we feel that our program is quite strong there. A licensure exam is a thing that following your education in dental school is something you have to take before you can practice. In dentistry, it still includes providing care to a patient under an examining protocol. Our history is consistently 98% pass rate on the first time that people take the exam. So the message, I guess, if there is a message here, is we have a very, very strong program to train people to become excellent beginning general dentists. And that's kind of our reputation on a national basis. See, at the dental school, we have about 80,000 patient visits per year. I think that's been very conservative. The last thing I saw, we were approaching 90,000, it looks like. One of the big things that adds to that is the reintroduction of the pediatric dentistry residency program. We had one that had been ongoing for many, many years. It was lost about 10, 12 years ago, in 1994, I believe. because of budget, and we were able to restart the program 2 years ago. This residency program, at the time, we created a new clinic. You may have seen something, Give Kids a Smile. It was a big event at the School of Dentistry this year, so we had lots of activity in this clinic. The key thing is we've added about 8,000 patient visits with this new clinic, where we're training dentists to become children's dentists or pediatric dentists. So it's a two-year program. So we're actually increasing the care that we're offering to the community by about 10% there. The next picture shows a little bit.
Excuse me, yes. Dr. Clinton, yes, a question from Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Clinton, I was wondering, just on those last 2 points, can you tell me about what percentage of the time your students spend doing public health?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, that's a great lead-in, because I'm going to be addressing that a little bit as one of our initiatives. As it turns out, the percentage is probably around 5%.
Okay.
Much of the care that we do on a public health basis is volunteer, so we will send students out to man to help man some of the volunteer clinics throughout the state, but it's usually on their time rather than part of the curriculum.
Okay.
We're very insightful, because this is something that I'm very passionate about, and we'll share with you in a couple minutes.
Sure.
Thank you. I wanted to share a little bit about our applicant pool. This slide shows the number of applicants to Oregon School Dentistry. The top line, the blue line, shows that about 1,000. We hit a little slump a few years ago. There's a lot of reasons probably doesn't make any difference, because there's way more people that are applying than we can allow, than we have positions for. You can see the red line, or the magenta line, down near what appears on this graph near the bottom. This represents the number of Oregonians that are applying to OHSU, the School of Dentistry. And if you look carefully at that, you can see since 1997 there has been a slight rise there. This is one of our challenges, to do a little better job of encouraging Oregonians to apply to dental school. And the bottom line shows the number of people that we matriculate. And this is absolutely capacity driven. Dental education is taught pretty much, every student has to have a pretty elaborate trappings, if you like, in order to learn dentistry. We now have increased, it's about 3 years old now, 4 years old, our preclinical training area, which is about a quarter of our the dental education program, has increased capacity to 75. So our graduation rates and our entrance rates now are based on 75 students rather than the 70 that was previously. So that's showing that we're growing as much as we can within the facility that we currently have. Next slide, quickly, I'll show that nationally, this 2006, there were 10,600 and some applicants to dental schools. There were over 1,000, or right at 1,000, that applied to Oregon. So of the 56 dental schools, Oregon is getting 10% of the pool wanting to come here. We think that's pretty commendable. For information, I guess, it works out to around 4,300 slots for entering students throughout the country in the 56 dental schools. The next slide is kind of an interesting one, and I guess we won't spend a lot of time on it. But what this very graphically shows, that workforce is a huge workforce shortage, projected workforce shortages in dentistry, like other healthcare professions, certainly medicine and nursing. We are just getting into a very acute phase of under available manpower. Next slide will show a little bit of it, and Oregon fits into that. That was a national. Oregon fits the almost exactly the same profile. You continually hear about it. We're all getting old like me and losing their hair like me. And these age groups up here on the top, I'm past those also. We are very proud in Oregon to share with you that 64% of the dentists, the practicing dentists in Oregon, are graduates of our school. Similarly, we have a number of states without dental schools where we have a very high practitioner rate there also. And a few of the other things, it's kind of interesting to know that about three quarters of the general of dentists are general practitioners, 20% are specialists. So it's kind of fun. And the other part, I guess, that we'll tie in a minute is that over half of the dental manpower in Oregon actually practices in Portland, in the urban area of Portland, and 20% are in rural settings, and we're going to try to skew that just a little bit. Demand for dental care, again, you've heard about it. I'll point out this third bullet here. I think that's it's certainly very interesting to me. It's very, very sad. And that when Oregon was deploying National Guard troops for service in Iraq, 25% of those reservists, and they had to have a dental evaluation, dental exam, 25% found that they had dental disease or dental conditions that were near an emergency basis or would be within a year. And some of them lost sound, teeth, and everything. So it's kind of a, to me, it's kind of a, another one of those indicators of the oral health of our general population. And this is a very vital part of our population, obviously. Another quick target here, the next shows you the support that School of Dentistry per student received from the state support. There are 37 publicly assisted dental schools in the country. Oregon is currently very near the end. We're 35 out of 37, where you can see the support per student is about $14,800, and that's represents about 21% of the revenue, and you can see the different ratios here. So in Oregon, we're not happy, but we're distinguished kind of near the bottom of the list. The exciting part, I guess, of what's going on and what I'm interested in primarily sharing with you are the program initiatives that we're talking about that are part of your budget consideration. And not on the slide are two key themes that I guess that drive what it is that we're trying to do. Number one is we do hope to have developed some of our strategy to influence the distribution of the workforce. That figure of 52% is urban and 20% rural. We do, in fact, have shortages, as many of you probably know, of dental care, appropriate and immediate dental care in rural settings throughout Oregon. And there seems to be an abundance in Portland. So we have something we'd like to deal with there. The second theme, I guess, is that we really do want to address the increasing enrollment. And there's a very dramatic way of doing that. It's called Build a School. And I'll mention just a little bit of that, another school at the end here. So our initiatives are, once again, we're looking to, we want to put greater emphasis on strengthening our core faculty base. We, too, like nursing and medicine, have a concern of a shortage of faculty and that again is a national trend. We're told that there's about 350 open positions at any given time nationally in all dental schools, and we kind of fit that. You divide that out by 56 dental schools, and we have four or five open positions that kind of seem to be a rolling type of thing, and recruiting is difficult, so we're hoping to strengthen our competitive edge there. This is the one that I'm really quite excited about, is establishing required outreach experience for all students. Right now, essentially all of our formal curriculum is within a school of dentistry or an OHSU facility. I'm convinced, and the school of dentistry is convinced, that we can make an impact with our workforce distribution if we can somehow get our dental students to have an experience in a setting other than a dental school. And so we're focusing on the non-traditional setting by places, the rural or the underserved types of clinics throughout Oregon. And the intent, we're partnering with the AHEC, the Area Health Education Committees at OHSU, and we're looking at partnering where every dental student will eventually have a significant rotational experience. We're calling it an immersion experience. We want to live in the community or live near that setting for 2 to 4 weeks. And of course the outcome, what we're looking at, is people are going to find out. I was interested in the discussion about in sending people to be teachers. I think we have the same thing in sending people to serve in underserved type of areas. I think if you get the experience, all at once you can begin to see some of the trade-offs. Maybe all those dollars isn't that important. Maybe the personal rewards of being part of a community, a very active part of a community, is worth it. And so the richness of our background. And of course, Dr. Halleck mentioned earlier in the introduction, I am very passionate about that. I am an Oregonian. I was born and I grew up in Lakeview. And if there's any place in Oregon that's rural, it is Lakeview. I was encouraged by a dentist to go to dental school. I was encouraged to come back and serve in that community. Somehow the faculty, the dean of the dental school at the time, got a hold of me first. And so I ended up, I've been on the faculty for forever. So in a way, continuing to serve Oregon and serve the community, it is something that I had two great choices, and both of them turned out to be ones that are maybe a little less lucrative than what we're training people to be. So I'm one of those people that I like to sell the living, the quality of life. I like to sell all the things that are not related to trappings. I think an immersion experience is going to make a difference. So that's what we're looking at in building this. Another initiative is kind of it's a double linked one. We have a hospital-based service here and a general practice residency program. And what I'm really looking at here is we do have a need, a void, I guess, in dental services at OHSU. And this void is related to inpatients that need dentistry that are really, the patients that are really sick. Think of transplants, think of dialysis, think of oncology, and we do know that quite often a dental disease, what seems to be an innocent dental condition or an infection, can have a tremendous negative, bad influence on outcomes of a very major life-threatening type of And we have a service. I want to intensely strengthen that service and provide the care there. We also, along with this, it's besides these patients, it'd be for inpatients, for those patients that are sometimes unable to handle the stress of receiving dental care in a practice setting. So being able to have a hospital setting for anesthesias and those kinds of things. So linked with a hospital dental service then is an opportunity to train people in a general practice residency. General practice residency is a 1-year experience after dental school. learning the kind of the specialties of dentistry, the specialties being endodontics, root canals, periodontics, the gum disease, oral surgery, the removal, some of the things that mostly specialists do, plus rotation in anesthesia and in the emergency room, the medical emergency room. Well, where does this make a difference? I found out that people that seek this kind of an experience, a GPR experience, which we do not have any in Oregon, are the same people that look to the reason they want to gain this kind of experience because they're planning to practice in a setting where there are not specialists convenient, which is the rural part of, and the underserved parts of. So I'm thinking if we had that here, bring people here to get that training, and somehow maybe even rotate them into some of these services while they're here, we have a good chance of retaining them and making a difference for some of the folks that are.
Dr. Clinton, we're about to get kicked out, so
I'm finished. You see, I have one last bullet, and that was I want to increase the enrollment of the dental school with the new school, the new campus that we're looking at, and right now we're talking about a 60% increase in enrollment, and that's of course down the line. Plant the seed. We'll be back passionately after you to help to support and help us get that school so we can make a big difference in dentistry. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr.
And I will hang around in the hallway or whatever for anybody that has questions.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much, and thank you to all of you who took the time to come out and testify, and we really appreciate it. Sorry to abruptly kind of cut things off, but we got to do, you understand? So, and of course, you're aware that tomorrow we're taking a little break from OHSU. I didn't mean to put it like that. It didn't sound very good. Anyway, you talked about root canal, so we have other matters, and then we're going to come back on Thursday to finish. So thank you very much. So now I'm going to close the public hearing on 5520. Members that we